It seems that not a day goes by without something in the news about an act of violence against women, sexual, physical, emotional, even economic. And when we talk about this topic, it's easy to couch it as just a women's issue. But let's be real here. It is an everyone issue, a human being issue. While it might be tempting to click away right now and call this topic a complete bummer, I urge you to consider the numbers and our responsibility to them. Because those numbers are staggering. According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, in the U.S., nearly 20 people per minute are physically abused by an intimate partner. That means that in the span of 1 year, over 10 million people are unsafe in what should be one of their closest of relationships. To put it in even starker terms, 1 in 3 women, and to be sure, 1 in 4 men, have been subject to some form of physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime. And the numbers continue to stun when we switch to the topic of human trafficking and exploitation, with tens of thousands of calls coming in to help hotlines each year and programs emerging, but not quickly enough for flight attendants and other service professionals to learn to stop the signs and intervene. But when we think about human trafficking, we tend to think about people on the other side of the world in desperate situations facing hard economic choices. And nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, as with partner violence, exploitation and sex trafficking can strike surprisingly close to home. I can personally attest it happened to a member of my own family. So, as long as any person is abusing a position of power over another, we have work to do, you and I. And as I said, it is not a women's issue, but an everyone issue. There are ways to help people close to us, and there are ways to help strangers. And tonight, we're going to talk about them. We'll be talking with people working to combat violence against women, sexual violence, emotional, physical, and economic. We'll talk with a filmmaker whose latest project documents human trafficking of young women in Ecuador, a music and social commentary writer to talk about recent allegations against R. Kelly, and with two women raising funding and awareness of human trafficking, as well as an attorney and advisory board member of a domestic violence prevention program here in Chicago. It's a serious topic, and we intend to take it head on in a proactive and empowering spirit. I'm Amy Guth, and it's all coming up tonight right here on the Saturday Night Special.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
You heard the woman. This is the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us tonight. Tonight on the program, we are talking with people working to combat violence against women. It takes many forms: sexual violence, emotional, physical, economic. We're going to talk with filmmaker Erica Valenciana, whose latest project documents human trafficking of young women in Ecuador, with social commentary writer Britt Julius about recent allegations against R. Kelly that's been in the news a lot, with two women raising funding and awareness of human trafficking happening right here in Chicago, and with Beth McCormick, an attorney and advisory board member of Between Friends, a domestic violence prevention organization here in Chicago. We have a lot to do tonight, a lot to discuss, and a lot to learn, and we have a pretty packed show, so I cannot swear that we're going to be able to take too many calls, but 312-981-7200, and esteemed producer Tom Hush will be that very friendly voice on the other end of the line if you do have a comment or question for one of our guests. Of course, you can also find me on social media. I'm at Amy Guth, G-U-T-H, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, Snapchat, all those places. So we'll be right back to get this conversation underway on 720 WGN.
Seven.
720 WGN. Hi there, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. I appreciate you sharing part of your weekend with me, as ever. So tonight's topic is no small one. We are talking about violence against women and the many forms that it takes. And part of the reason that we have chosen to do this topic right now, tonight, is because R. Kelly has again been in the news. And here to discuss that with us is Britt Julius, who is a music and social commentary writer. Britt, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Hello, thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday to talk with us. So you write about so many intersections of art and culture and social issues, and this seems to really be hitting on a lot of them at the same time. So for those who perhaps are not familiar with the most recent allegations against R. Kelly, if you could just kind of give us an overview of that a bit, and then I want to backtrack a little bit because this is not the first time that such misconduct has been alleged against him.
Absolutely. So Jim DeRogatis, who is the music reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, he actually came out with a really long and important report on BuzzFeed, specifically talking about R. Kelly and sort of new development in terms of his sort of relationship towards, you know, women. And so in the piece, you know, it was titled, you know, R. Kelly is holding women against their will in a cult, parents told police. And so in the piece, he sort of discusses how Kelly essentially has been grooming a handful of young women from a young age when, you know, they were of legal age, usually like 18 or 19 years old. The women eventually end up sort of living with him either in his Atlanta home or his Chicago home. And there are a number of different, rules that are applied towards them, right? So they're not allowed to, speak to their friends or family without Kelly's permission. He gives them a phone in which they can make calls instead of, you know, sort of them having their own phone. They're not allowed to leave the premises without his permission and things like that. And a lot of the story is coming from the perspective of the parents of some of these young women, and they sort of discuss how their daughters got into these particular situations. A lot of times the women were trying to become singers or performers, and they sort of came under Kelly's wing basically because he was sort of coming from the perspective of he's going to be like a mentor towards them, going to help them in the business, things like that. And then eventually the daughters began to pull farther and farther away from their family, and contact was cut off. So it's a really really in-depth, really well-reported story that goes back a number of years, and a really important one as well.
Yeah, indeed. And there's a couple of different publications. DeRogatis has done a bit of one, but also Spin has a really interesting kind of timeline that starts in 1994 when he marries the then 15-year-old Aaliyah. And it just seems like there's all these things, and we all remember the sex tape that came out that was alleged to be with a 14-year-old, and all this stuff is just this, it really points at this pattern. These allegations, I don't think surprised anybody, because this seems to be a behavior pattern that we've seen again and again with very young women and girls. So immediately, I think this narrative and this debate and conversation erupted on social media around what it means to be a fan and what it means to participate in someone's work and buy their music and listen to it, and when their moral fiber is in question. We saw this with Manchester by the Sea, with Casey Affleck facing some sexual misconduct allegations, and I wonder if you could just speak to that a bit, because I feel like that comes up a lot with celebrities, but in particular around R. Kelly, this has come up in such a big way, just because of this same narrative arc that keeps coming up around him.
Right. I think, the interesting thing about Kelly is that, people have been aware of you know, his interactions, his grooming, his relationships with much younger women, like you said, since the 90s. But there seems to be this kind of like willful ignorance in terms of his history, right? Because, you know, he continues to release music, and then people seem to, they're aware of who he is, but, you know, they think it's him and his sort of past, you know, conduct or alleged conduct as sort of, you know, oh, Peach is kind of like freaky, or he's like weird, or he's strange, but like no one's actually speaking to the specifics of what happened and the specifics of the multiple, you know, cases or the settlements or things like that. And I think that really allows for people to then sort of like separate the art from the artist and feel like, okay, well, I have no problem sort of like listening to the art. Like, I know he's weird, but that's like the extent of it. And I think that's like, in particular, that's something that we've seen again and again with Kelly, because he wouldn't be able to, you know, continue recording music and making appearances at, you know, nightclubs or casinos or performance venues if he didn't have that fan base. And by now, you know, after 20 plus years, there's no way that his fan base, who are, you know, probably in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, would not be aware of the stories that have come out about him. So I think, you know, there's a lot of sort of like willful ignorance that's coming, that's happening sort of in the case of Kelly. And then also, you know, I think it sort of speaks to the larger sort of idea of race culture, and that, you know, we are, you know, in some ways, you know, people are in some ways placing blame on these young women in particular and saying, well, they knew what he was like and X, Y, and Z. And so because of that, you know, they're able to excuse the actions or excuse the allegations rather than sort of like addressing them head on and being like, wait a minute, this is not okay. We should talk about this. Why are we still sort of actively listening to his music and giving this person money?
Right. I mean, so much of the conversation that we've seen have been around the girl's parents right now.
Mm-hmm.
Very little about this guy and
yeah.
Very little about this long pattern of you know, these same thing, type of things that keep coming up around him. And so, you know, we after, let's see, after 2008, when he was acquitted for the child pornography charges over that summer, we didn't hear from him for a very long time. And it seems like he kind of, all this resurfaced a bit after he was booked to perform at Pitchfork a few years later. And then he kind of went quiet again. And so it seems like are we in a moment in which the public, public memory is there's just so much coming at us that we can easily forget things? Or is this part of that we have an expectation of behavior for celebrities, particularly male celebrities, that we're willing to dismiss certain behaviors as, oh, that's just kind of, what do you expect with someone with money and power? Or both?
I think it's definitely a little bit of both, but in particular, you know, I think what we're seeing is a lot more of the latter. You know, male celebrities again and again are allowed to return to the public eye. You know, they can sort of give an apology, or they can say they have remorse or regret, and then their actions are sort of, you know, eventually sort of swept under the rug. There's always going to be, you know, people who remember it, people who like no longer want to sort of watch their movies or listen to their music or things like that. But in general, we're much more willing to forgive male celebrities for everything from sexual violence and sexual abuse to domestic violence and so on, as long as they sort of, you know, show some sort of remorse or go through the steps and the stages. Or, you know, sometimes not even, they don't really even have to do that at all. They just have to, as you said before, disappear from the public eye. We forget about them, you know, we move on. There's other things that, you know, continue to happen. And then we sort of, you know, start, you know, engaging with their sort of forms of entertainment that they're providing for us. And certainly what happened with Kelly, you know, between the years of 2008 and 2013, when the Pitchfork Music Festival happened, and it was, you know, really important that conversation again sort of came back into the public eye with that year, because one, there was a whole generation of young people who probably weren't very aware of what happened or knew the logistics of Kelly's background, especially if they weren't from Chicago in particular. But then also, you know, Pitchfork Music Festival takes place in Chicago. And so it was sort of a very, you know, now we can sort of like look back and be like, that's a very strange choice. So, yeah, I think it's like you said, like a mix of both, but more so that we are much more willing to forgive male celebrities for their actions and their indiscretions far more than female celebrities for whatever they may do.
Right, indeed. We're talking with culture and social commentator Britt Julius. You mentioned rape culture and as we are looking at that, particularly as it's applying to celebrities, I think particularly musicians, we associate kind of this, you know, the rock and roll kind of lifestyle. As you said, we have this expectation of behavior that might be different from people, men in our lives. And so in your mind, and you write about so much of this, but in your mind, what will it take to start to shift that culture where we will not be as, I don't want to say permissive, but we won't be, where we will be shocked and appalled and hold our rock stars a little more accountable, and, you know, hold male performers more accountable for actions such as these?
You know, I actually think it's the sort of thing where I think it's really important when we're sort of, you know, discussing or talking about this is really recognizing that it's not just, you know, celebrities and rock stars that we're talking about that we sort of give permission and, you know, we forgive and things like that. It happens so often in our everyday lives. I was actually working on a piece about this and about specifically this culture that we have, you know, as it relates to rape culture, where, you know, we hear stories or rumors or have warnings about, you know, like a, you know, creepy teacher or a weird coach or things like that. But we sort of, you know, we forgive them. We allow the person to still be in the same capacity that they were in before. My mother actually had a really great, or really, not great, but a really, you know, telling story about how when she was in high school, she was always given warnings by older girls, like, you know, in her class, about a teacher at her school and how he was creepy and he would give them, you know, massages and all these kind of weird things. And then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, after she graduated college and she came back to her school to teach there, she learned that, you know, those rumors were in fact true, but people were really sort of sweeping it under the rug. Or they were like, well, he's so beloved, everyone, you know, he's the best teacher in the world, so we're just going to, you know, forgive him and just, you know, instead, because it was a school that, you know, was predominantly full of young black women, we're just going to believe instead that, you know, they're promiscuous or they're fat or they're loose and things like that. So I think, you know, as it sort of relates to celebrities in particular, it's going to take us, you know, actually doing the work in our everyday lives. Because I think most people, you know, have these sort of, you know, stories or they've heard these rumors or things like that about people in their own lives, and yet they continue to interact with them, they continue to engage with them, they continue to excuse their behavior because they don't know the specifics or because they don't want to know the specifics or they have some sort of, you know, history or personal relationship, you know, to that particular person. I think once we start to sort of address it from the day-to-day, that's going to allow us then to see celebrities, you know, if they're sort of, you know, doing these same things or doing similar things and actually, you know, be outraged and have that sort of, you know, sustained outrage as well. I think, you know, as it comes to Kelly, the sort of, you know, reactions that people had towards him between 2008 and 2013 was really muted. But, you know, ever since Pitchfork, as we've sort of, you know, grown into a society that discusses, you know, things like sexual assault and rape and rape culture and the sort of, you know, things of that nature, I think people have been able to really sort of sustain their outrage and, you know, continue to not engage with his music or his artistry.
Indeed. Yeah. To rewind back to your mother's story for a minute. I think so we hear that so much, right? That something turns out something did happen, but no one wants to be the whistleblower or the person to make it awkward or if you do, there are real consequences for doing that because it's, you mentioned he was this beloved character in this school.
Mm-hmm.
That I feel like that plays out so many times where we look at, well, but we don't want to ruin him. He's so cherished and he has this future ahead of him. And it seems like it's always about the perpetrator's potential loss of positive things, and so much for the woman, it's not about what she might have lost. It's about her character or her past, and that's such a fascinatingly unfair you know, rubric by which we gauge people in these situations. Well, I wish we could sit here and talk about this all night. Indeed, we have run out of time, though. But Britt Julius, thank you so much for being with us tonight and talking about this on this night where we're talking all about violence against women tonight on the program. Thank you so much, Britt.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all of that good stuff. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us. We are talking tonight about violence against women and the many, many forms that it takes. We were just talking with social commentary writer Britt Julius a little bit about the recent allegations against R. Kelly, and those involve the accusation that he has been keeping young women against their will. But often when we talk about this idea of human trafficking, sex trafficking, labor trafficking, it does take many forms. But often when we talk about that, we think about it being on the other side of the world, someone else's problem. It doesn't happen here. And as I said in the opening monologue, that could not be further from the truth. And I also mentioned it is a personal issue to me, as that happened to a member of my family. So I know for a fact it can be anywhere, and it can happen to absolutely anyone. And so that's why this is a topic I take so very seriously, but also one I want to tackle proactively and really shine a light on people who are doing the same and addressing it in a way that is tactical and empowering and really about eradication and supporting people. And that leads us to our guests. We have in studio with us Mary Munoz and Marie Anderson, who are part of a really interesting event that's just about a week away, and I wanted to talk about that tonight. It's connected to the Hidden Tears Project, and they are co-producers of that event. Marie and Mary, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Thanks, Amy.
So tell us about the Hidden Tears Project and how you came to be involved in it.
So the Hidden Tears Project is actually a media organization, a nonprofit that teams up with other Hollywood producers, actors, and directors to put together media for an opportunity to change the way that Hollywood talks about men and women and human trafficking. Excuse me.
And they're in LA.
Mm-hmm. And tell us what that way is, because I'm sure there are so many, as with anything, there are often missing narratives and things that get oversimplified or things that are just dead wrong. And what are the things that are usually misrepresented when it comes to human trafficking in film and television?
Well, I am not an expert just yet on sex trafficking, thank goodness, but I'm an expert in the modeling business, which is often utilized as an opportunity to access people for, whether you call it human trafficking or sex trafficking. Hidden Tears Project, they produce all sorts of media to help spread awareness and prevention of both of those areas.
And if you could tell us a bit about your role in the modeling industry and how you have seen human trafficking intersect there.
Just last summer, one of my teen models was walking alone in a high-end mall here.
And you say mine, you mean...
I'm sorry.
Because you're right. An agent of...
As an agent of fashion modeling agencies, and I say agencies, I have almost 40 years of experience, so there's been multiple generations. Anyway, one of my former models that I used to represent was shopping by herself in a high-end mall here in Chicago, and before she knew it, she realized that there were three separate men who were trying to solicit her outside of the mall, and thankfully she had taken... a year before, a workshop at Chicago Fitness Center that I produced on self-awareness, situational awareness, and self-defense. So thankfully, she knew to run to a safe place where she went to one of the stores, and they called the police. The police arrived, and out of the three men, one was arrested and was immediately identified as one of the most wanted men on Michigan Avenue for sex trafficking. That happened just last summer, and interestingly enough, not necessarily here in Chicago, but in December of last year, I was doing a speaking engagement in Los Angeles addressing 1,000 people on how to become a model, and I talked about social media and the importance of G-rated and, mm-hmm. you know, explaining how to produce your social media. And two of the teenagers stood to the side, and after I was done, like, signing autographs and everything, the two girls came up and they said, we want to let you know that we're going to be able to follow all your advice, but we can't follow the advice on social media. We cannot do social media. We're in Alaska. And I said, I don't understand. I thought it was a technology thing. And they said, no, it's because of the sex trafficking. Our area is so ridden with abductions that we can't post ourselves on social media. Our girlfriends are already being abducted. So, you know.
Stunning.
Yeah. So that was just one of my teenagers last summer, two teenagers from Alaska. Like, it's constantly coming into my world, so that's mm-hmm. why I finally thought, I have to do something about this. Yeah. I have to be proactive.
Yeah, yeah. That's my rule in life, is if you catch yourself saying, someone's got to do something about this, then that someone should be you. Mm. So good for you for following that. I when you say it, it makes sense, but prior to that, I wouldn't have thought Alaska being this spot. I mean, I was looking at some state-by-state data prior to the show tonight. I saw California was one of the highest. New York was one of the highest because of international, you know, travel. But even here in Illinois, there's quite a bit of it. And I was learning about some programs for flight attendants to kind of learn those signs, because you have a special opportunity in an aircraft when, you know, someone gets up to go to the lavatory, something like that. You have a special opportunity where you have someone by themselves who you may not otherwise, you know, have a chance to question or help or mm-hmm. signal or something like that. And so tell us about the event that's coming up, and particularly how that's going and what we can expect, where people can go to find out more about it, and who it's raising money for.
Okay, so the event is entitled Safe, Savvy, Successful, An Agent's Guide to Becoming a Model. That is going to be taking place at Chicago Artist Studios at 3036 West Chicago on July 30th at 11 a.m. Tickets are only $25, so we hope that...
Someone's Siri is going off.
Yeah.
Rude.
Yeah.
I have set Siri off many times just by saying... You know, seriously, and suddenly
exactly
Siri hears her name and off she goes.
Yes.
That's okay. Siri's part of our modern world, so she's welcome in this studio. That's quite all right.
Well, and the event, I'm sorry, Amy, the event is to benefit the survivors mm-hmm. Here in Chicago. It's a newly established grassroots support group that Hidden Tears from Los Angeles has established here in Chicago. So a portion of the proceeds are going to go to that organization to get them launched this summer.
Excellent. And we're going to talk about that organization here in just a moment. We're talking with Marie Anderson and Mary Munez. They're co-producers of this event that is coming up on July 30th. We're going to be sure and put something up on WGN Radio, and I will also tweet it out and post it on Facebook. If you're connected to me on social media, I will be sure and share that with you so you can attend or support it or all of that good stuff. But we're going to take a little break. We are talking all about violence against women tonight and the many, many forms that it takes, particularly in this area. We're talking about trafficking, which is one we do not talk about nearly enough. So back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hi there, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. And tonight, as ever, we pick one big topic, and we talk about it all evening. Tonight's topic is about violence against women and the many, many forms that it takes. And as we were saying at the top of the program, it is not a women's issue. It's an everyone's issue. And it's one that we need to be talking a lot more about. In particular, we were talking earlier in the show about recent allegations against R. Kelly, but now we've shifted a bit to talk about the topic of human trafficking, which I think is one that is very easy to put out of our minds and think about it being something done in desperation on the other side of the world, and that could not be further from the truth. And so we're here talking with Marie Anderson and Mary Munez, who are co-producers of an event that is coming up on July 30th that is connected to the Hidden Tears Project, and they are connected to the Chicago Survivors Group that is really all about overcoming and surviving human trafficking. So a lot of really important work being done here. I'm thrilled that you're both in studio with us talking about this really important issue, but if you could tell us a bit more about Hidden Tears Project and in particular some of their work around just the practical information. I mean, when we think about this, we think, well, that's unfortunate. What, there's nothing I can do. And I think there's so many false narratives about who is involved in that and how powerless we are. But in fact, that's not true at all.
Right. Marie, actually, if you could help me out with this topic.
Oh, you were want to bring up some of the tips and how
yes.
we can.
So I wanted to talk about kind of identifying the potential victims, right?
Yeah.
And you know, you think that they are, like you said earlier, just people that are overseas and in weird kind of situations. But, you know, here, just alone in Chicago, you could very well be seeing someone working at a hotel or, you know, at a restaurant or at a club even. And, you know, you want to see what... you know, look at somebody and see if they're, you know, maybe living with their employer. Do they have poor living conditions? Are they several people crammed up into one space? If they seem like they have answers that seem scripted or rehearsed, and if they feel like they can't talk to someone individually, those are things that you really have to pay attention to. And you know, how are you going to... respond to those people? How are you going to approach them and, you know, asking them if they can leave their job, if they want to, if they can come and go as they please? Have they ever been hurt? Have they, do they have family that's being threatened? You know, these are things to ask to anybody that you feel could be a potential victim.
And I think the pushback with so many things is people say, that sounds like an awkward conversation. I don't know that I could say that to a stranger. I think people say that a lot. We, just a few weeks ago, we were talking about driving under the influence and having that conversation. And so many people push back saying, but I don't want to ruin my relationship, or I don't want to make it weird in my family. I don't want to ruin Thanksgiving, all these things. And really, you have to just say weigh the risk and reward at that point. But what is that conversation, and what do you do if it is confirmed, if someone says, well, I am and I do need some help?
Well, for starters, you could contact the National Human Trafficking Hotline, and that number is 888-373-7888. You can also try to give them empowering opportunities, like providing jobs or internships, things that will get them away from that situation. Give them skills training and giving them the opportunity to speak to other survivors and let them know that they're not the only ones and that there is a safe place for them.
Indeed. And there are films where, in fact, we're going to talk with a filmmaker a little bit later in the program about sex trafficking in Ecuador. We're going to talk with her at 8:30. But there is another film, and you have connection to that, too, and we'll be screening that. This Chicago is really just the biggest small town in the world, and that's my favorite thing about this place, really. But the Midwest Film Festival, which is a monthly event, the first Tuesday of the month, they do really, really fascinating stuff. But August 1st, they're having the Female Filmmakers Night, and there is a film there that is connected to this topic that you were also going to be screening at some point. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, Tanya, spelled T-A-N-Y-A, is a film short that was directed by Chicago Fire's star, Monica Raymond, and also the stars within that film short, Tanya, are also other stars from Chicago Fire, so it's very much a Chicagoland collaboration. And so this particular Sunday after my modeling seminar, we're going to screen Tanya, and as you said, and then somebody from the film will be there to talk about sex trafficking and empowerment and awareness and prevention, and then why they produced Tanya and why did they do that here in Chicago.
Yeah, and you know, I think a lot of times don't think about Chicago being a particular spot for that, but in fact, we do have a very major hub airport, and anytime you have a major hub airport, an international one anyway, you see this. This is a thing that happens, and so this is happening in Chicago a lot more than we perhaps realize.
I don't know if you saw on the news, I think it was this week, I kind of get lost in time, but it was just in Naperville in the last few days that they found a sex trafficking ring for children. And if I've got the stats right, they found 156 pairs of shoes, which suggested that that's how many children had been in that home. So it's like, not to freak out Naperevillians,
sure.
Naperevillians, but, you know, this is everywhere, as you say. It's not just one specific spot. And as I understand it, in D.C. alone, there have been several hundred low-income African-American and Hispanic daughters that have been abducted, and there's also a crisis going on in St. Louis. So it's a global issue. Mm-hmm. It's not just an American issue.
Right, right. And I think it's so interesting, Marie, in your work in particular, you know, we think about the modeling industry being quite glamorous. I mean, we hear things about casting couches and stuff like that, but not perhaps this overt of exploitation and kidnapping and this sort of violence in this way. And so I really applaud that you're bringing light to this. But what, you know, what... when did you decide, really, that it was like, I have to do more here? And when did it just become too much to not, you know, to not, I want to say ignore, but, you know, where you knew you had to act?
Well, when my teen was nearly abducted.
Yeah, yeah, at that point. Was it on your radar that much prior to that? Or was that
no,
when it really snapped
I was,
into focus?
I was aware of it, but it was it happening to her that I was like, that's just one degree from me. Like, I have to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been very much a creative activist in the business. And I had a fashion department called Agency Galatea inside of Grossman and Jack Talent, where for 7.5 years I fought the sexual objectification of my models.
Mm.
And I was always a bit of a, I don't know, a rabble-rouser, you know. And people didn't like that very much, but I didn't care. And so I worked really, really hard to not allow my models to have unzipped jeans or not allow them to take their tops off or to have sheer garments. So to me, it's all part of an ongoing kind of a sexual deviant kind mm-hmm. of mentality. And I had an argument with a top photographer, and he said, "Marie, you got to get over it. You know, sex sells." And I said, "Yeah, sex sells the soul." And when I was much younger, I have to admit, when I was in my early 20s, I didn't know any better because when I was running Elite Chicago then, I was drinking, as they say, the Kool-Aid, where, you know, this is just the process and what you do. And I had had a fiance at the time. I was being offered to pose for Playboy, Penthouse, and a French magazine called Louis. And I desperately wanted to do that because I wanted to be adored and everybody loved me and da da da. And my fiance at the time put his foot down. He said, "Absolutely not. I'm not going to let you do that." And I was so mad at him. But I'm so thankful now in this awareness as an adult, because there's no way I believe that parents would trust me with their teens if I had done that in my past. And also, it's not about me specifically, but it does involve the models, where I experienced sexual assault on multiple occasions. That was before my martial arts training, by the way. But I experienced sexual assault on multiple occasions within the fashion business. And I saw how, as a victim, I went mute. Because I was so terrified of losing my job or exposing that top photographer or exposing that top publisher over in Italy. Like, I just went into this mute stage. And thankfully, as I got older, I started to learn a voice that I needed to share. And so here I am now with sex trafficking, sharing my voice.
We're very glad that you are. Thank you so much for doing that. And so where can people go to find out more about the Hidden Tears Project?
You're going to go to hiddentearsproject.org, or you can also look up our event on Facebook. We have an events page called Safe, Savvy, Successful, an agent's guide on becoming a model, and we can redirect you to them as well.
Excellent. And again, we are going to share that link, and we'll be sure and tweet it out. If you follow me on any social media platform, I'll be sharing that. So you can be sure and find that, again, benefiting the work that's being done by the Hidden Tears Project, HiddenTears.org, and that is all connected to the Chicago Survivors Group. So thank you so much for being with us tonight, Mary Munoz and Marie Anderson, to talk about this really important topic. I know it's one we don't talk about nearly enough, and it's one that for reasons that are not totally clear all the time, it easily falls to the background. So thank you both for being here and doing the work that you're doing to help bring light to this very important one.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you for having us.
All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news, all that good stuff here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth and the Saturday Night Special. Thank you for being with us tonight. Always very grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday evening with me. So as ever, we pick one big topic and we spend the entire night talking about different parts of it. And tonight is no exception. Tonight we're talking about violence against women and the many forms that it takes. But we're really focusing on people who are working to combat that, because it is the kind of topic where people go, oh, that's such a big thing. In fact, just now as I was saying that, there was a couple men standing on Michigan Avenue, and as soon as I said what the topic was, they both jumped and walked away. Walked away. I'm calling them out. I think they can still hear me, but nonetheless. Because that's what we tend to do when we talk about this topic. It's an uncomfortable one. We flinch. We don't know how to have awkward conversations. We don't know what to do about it, if anything. So sometimes we don't do anything. And that is what we really are working to change. And that is why we are talking with people who are doing this important work in this area. We have joining us now by phone, Beth McCormick. She is a partner at Bierman, Pritikin, Mirabelli, Swerdlove Law Firm, and also on the advisory council at Between Friends. It's an organization that's working to combat domestic violence and prevent it from occurring in the first place. Beth, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Hello, Amy.
Hi, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday to talk with us about this very important issue. So to begin, could you tell us a bit about the work at Between Friends?
Between Friends is a domestic violence agency serving women and children primarily, and they do that through counseling the women and the children. There's a court advocacy program, so the women who may be seeking orders of protection have court advocates who work with them when they appear in court and prepare the paperwork with them. There's also a teen dating violence and prevention program. Its acronym is REACH, and that program goes into the schools and teaches children healthy relationships to prevent domestic violence.
All very important, very important aspects of this, because we, you know, it seems when we kind of first walk up to that topic, it seems like a very, very big one, and it's, I think, often very misunderstood. In the work that you're doing, what are the common misconceptions, or what does the dominant narrative about domestic violence usually miss or get wrong?
I feel like very often there's victim blaming. We're constantly trying to help people understand that domestic violence is not something that happens overnight. It's a gradual progression, so that in a dating relationship, very often it starts by maybe trying to control the person. So domestic violence is power and control, and it often takes the form of physical abuse, but it's really not just physical abuse. True domestic violence is a power and control issue.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And it's easy to blame the victim who won't leave the relationship, but unfortunately, by the time it gets to the place of physical abuse, they feel so trapped they can't leave for many reasons, emotional, but very often financial.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, right. There, we hear about this all the time that, you know, you hear there's staggering numbers. We were talking about a little bit earlier in the program about how often, you know, if there's a weapon involved, the likelihood that something will escalate to the point of homicide goes up 500%, just staggering numbers. And so often after that, when someone has been seriously injured or killed, that's when we hear people saying, why didn't she leave? Why didn't she tell someone? You know, it gets so, I hear that too. This often it's very much victim blaming and why would she date him? Why would this happen? You know, instead of how dare he do that to her. How dare, you know, if so much of it is about her and her agency or perception of lack thereof against her own life. And so I'm very interested in this teen dating program that you've developed, because it seems like having these conversations early it's so essential.
Right. So Yesenia Maldonado, our current executive director at Between Friends, actually started this program when she was a counselor at Between Friends and has worked her way up to run the agency. So we're especially proud of that. She created this curriculum to help these students understand what we're talking about now, and that is what I was discussing on the issue of the young men typically exerting power and control in a relationship, often taking the girls away from their friends, away from their family, trying to control their every move, perhaps telling them what they can wear, how to act, how to behave properly, and to ensure that they're with them at all times. And that's the form of power and control. The program teaches them that that's not a healthy relationship. It's very often thought a teenage girl might be flattered by the attention given to her, and trying to teach the young women that that's not healthy, and trying to teach the young men that they don't need to do that in order to have a healthy relationship.
Yeah, and that's so important. I feel like so many conversations we have about partner violence with teens in particular, it's focused on the girls. It's really it very, you know, I feel like not enough conversation is being had with young men about keeping behavior, like doing the right thing and being a good partner and consent and all that. You know, we're so willing to teach young women about you know, self-defense and all of these things, and yet we still are so reluctant or less likely to be talking with young men about consent and respect and all of these things.
Unfortunately, very often the young men and women are seeing it at home. So you're having to kind of retrain them a bit on what a healthy relationship is, because they may have watched their parents and saw that they did not have a healthy relationship, and that's all they know. Yeah. So this may be the first time they've ever heard what a healthy relationship really should look like.
Right. And then shifting a bit to the work that you do as partner in a law firm, where does that intersect there with domestic violence and law? Because I think at least so often in the dominant narrative, the way we talk about this the most, it tends to be we hear about legal things getting involved once it is escalated quite dramatically, when we're talking about restraining orders and things like that. What pieces do we not know about the legal end of this and the work that you do in that way?
So in our firm, we primarily focus on family law, and in family law, that very often is divorce, and a true survivor of domestic violence is in the most danger when she makes the decision to change. So there often has to be a safety protocol set up in order to ensure that when the spouse, and of course I'm being gender specific, yeah, realizing that there are men who are also victims, so pardon that, but that's just the statistics reveal that that's important to note.
Right.
So when she is about to leave the marriage or attempt to leave the marriage, she is often in the most danger. Again, that's statistical. And so we have to ensure that when he is served with the divorce document, that he's also served with an order of protection to ensure that she's as safe as she can be. We often tell survivors that it's just a piece of paper. You have to have a whole safety protocol in place in addition to the order of protection to ensure that she's safe. So in the legal world, we're preparing, in addition to the petition for divorce, documents in order to get an order of protection, which is a bit different than a restraining order, but I don't want to get into all those nuances tonight. It probably doesn't make sense, but it's important for people to know that an order of protection is the best that the law can do to protect the survivor, and that it's enforceable by, if there is a violation, there is an arrest, and violating an order of protection is a misdemeanor. So most people are deterred by that and respect the order of protection. Of course, again, we remind survivors that it's just a piece of paper.
Right, right, which I feel like that's a very important point to underscore, because so often, I mean, that carries words, right? I mean, that carries weight. That sounds very official and very, you know, very scary, and it is, we hear so often about, you know, police are summoned or something like that. Once legal things get involved, it sometimes people become intimidated or feel very guilty and tend to, you know, back down a little bit, because that sounds so very official. And so, you know, I think it can almost be perceived a bit like a punishment when there's so much fear of punishing somebody who is in fact the abuser. But nonetheless, I think that can be a very terrifying moment.
It is. So again, the court advocates are there to be with the survivor, to remind her that this is not her fault, to continue to help her deal with the emotion involved with taking those steps in order to protect herself and her children. And, you know, again, counselors who understand domestic violence have to help them get through that fear, additional fear, the fear of the system. The system is often very, very difficult on survivors, because in order to keep the order of protection, they have to testify in court against their abuser. And that obviously is terrifying. So they have to be prepared.
Right, and can completely re-traumatize someone who's quite, you know, in a vulnerable state. And so,
absolutely.
How can people be a good ally? You know, this is so common. I mean, to look at the numbers from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, it's quite staggering. 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men have been victims of some sort of physical violence, and that's just physical. That's not about emotional or financial. 1 in 7 women and 1 in 18 men have been stalked by an intimate partner during their lifetime, to the point in which they felt fearful or believed they or someone close to them would be harmed or killed. That's statistically speaking, just getting on the bus, there's a handful of people that have been, you know, that have been subjected to this. So how can we be good allies to someone that we either know or suspect are in trouble here in this capacity?
I think by asking questions, I always tell people, just be curious. When someone is talking to you about their relationship, I think as adults, we have a good radar as to what's healthy and what's not, to help a person who might not understand just how dangerous their situation is. Asking lots of questions about this issue of power and control, and that line between what's a healthy relationship and what's not. Very often, again, saying you'll be there for her, to walk alongside her through this terrifying journey. But it's important to be there, again, emotionally and financially, because very often they're staying because they're trapped. They feel that there's no way out. And I think by being a friend who's willing to offer that emotional support, but often financial support, because they probably will have to embark upon a legal journey. That's expensive. They may leave the house. They may have to have a place to live. So it's very important for people to ask the questions and figure out how they can really help with support whatever the woman needs.
And what about language when we're talking? I think it seems anyway like it's such a fragile moment. And if someone confides in you, you know, is there language to be very careful about, other than just being extremely supportive and hyper aware of not blaming the person who is experiencing domestic violence?
Just listening. I think all too often if a human's need to take care of someone, they feel that they have to be directive and tell a person what they need to do and when they need to do it. It's important to let that timing, provided there's no physical danger, mm-hmm. let that timing take its course. because, again, the victim's going to know very well when it's going to be the right time. And if a friend is dictating and saying, you need to do this now, and it needs to be on these terms, you're not helping. So, again, the curious, open-ended questions is usually the most powerful. And then just making sure they know what their resources are. I'm sure you have the National Domestic Violence Hotline. There are many agencies in the city that will provide all sorts of services, from counseling, legal, ensuring the kids are also provided counseling. So I think just offering that as a place to go would be best, but then, not directing what they have to do.
Right, right. And then as for the teen program, what about parents who might be concerned that their child is perhaps involved in an unhealthy relationship? What is that conversation like?
Again, it's important to ask the curious questions as to how does that feel? How does that make you feel? Asking questions about just how far it's gone. Again, it very rarely starts with physical abuse. It's going to be more about this power and control. You know, asking questions about why are you serving him this, or why is it that you feel the need to do whatever he wants? You know, does it feel comfortable to you that he gets to decide what you do all the time? Then it evolves into he's telling you what to wear. He's telling you how to talk. He's telling you how to act. Asking questions about how that really feels, again, rather than judging and dictating how it should go. Most of us know that teenagers don't respond well to that.
Right.
Staying curious is going to be your best advice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much for all this information. And where can people go to find out more about Between Friends?
The website is betweenfriendschicago.org. I think that's the best place. Again, it's important for survivors to know to be safe when looking online, because the perpetrator may be watching every move. So be sure to watch and ensure that anytime you look at any website that you're mindful of the possible danger involved with that.
That is a very important tip with the browser history and whatever. So maybe something to access from a workplace rather than home. Indeed, that's
correct.
Very wise. Thank you so much. Beth McCormick, partner at Bierman, Pritikin, Mirabelli, and Swerdlove, and advisory council board member at Between Friends. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, Beth.
Thank you, Amy. Good night.
Thank you. All right, we're going to take a little break. Back in just a minute here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth. It's the Saturday Night Special. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. Shout out to everybody on Michigan Avenue visiting. We've got a sign out there. It's a group visiting from Mexico. Great to meet you. Great to see you. Thanks for being with us. Tonight, as ever, we take one big, big topic and we talk about it all night. And tonight, that topic is about violence against women. And coming up on the other side of the news, we are going to be talking with filmmaker Erica Valenciana about her documentary about sex trafficking in Ecuador. A really, really beautiful film, wonderful work that she does, and super, super important. And that film, she's working on it right now. And so we're going to be talking with her about that. But as we've been talking tonight about this big topic about violence against women, some interesting things have occurred. A little bit earlier tonight, we came back from break and I mentioned it and I said, here's the topic that we're talking about tonight. And there was a couple of men standing there on Michigan Avenue and they both flinched and scurried away, which I thought was very, very interesting, because it is one of those topics that we are sometimes afraid to get into because it seems like a downer. But so tonight we've been talking a lot about talking with people who are doing work in this area and trying to combat different aspects of violence against women. And it's certainly nothing that we can solve here in the span of 2 hours, but I think it is important to have these conversations, because so with so many issues, when we talk about big topics, sometimes people say, well, it's awkward. I don't want to ask. I suspect, but I don't want to ask. I don't know. It's weird, or, you know, And we've been talking a little bit, too, tonight about human trafficking. And that takes many, many forms. We think of that as being something on the other side of the world. We think that we think about that being about sex work. But, in fact, that can be labor trafficking. That can be a lot of different things. There's a lot of really good resources on the there's a website, the National Human Trafficking Hotline. If you Google that, you will find their website. And they have some really fascinating information. And they have wonderful education there and a lot of information on why it exists, what you can do to be a good ally, how you can help if you suspect that is going on. There's a lot of things, but I think one of the big takeaways for me tonight is really all about not flinching away from difficult conversations. To be a good ally, you need to ask questions. And as we were just talking about with our last guest, Beth McCormack from Between Friends, you can find out about them from BetweenFriendsChicago.org. That's a domestic violence prevention organization. She said some very, very powerful things, and one of them was to be curious and ask open-ended questions and don't dictate, don't give advice, but listen and be a good ally and be supportive. I think that's so very, very important. And so a lot of things to think about tonight. And as I said, on the other side of news, we're going to be talking with filmmaker Erica Valenciana about her work on a documentary film about sex trafficking in Ecuador. And the film is really centering around some very young women. I mean, to put this in perspective, this is about middle school age. It's young women that lots of reasons and lots of things have created this unfortunate circumstance for them. And so there's a ton of information. And again, also you can go to National Coalition Against Domestic Violence and read some of this powerful numbers, because there's so many there. And these are but two aspects when we think about violence against women. We're talking about trafficking, we're talking about domestic violence, but all of those take many forms, and there's so much to be done. And so I hope we keep having these conversations. But for now, let us go to news. Let us reset a moment. And when we come back, we will be talking with our filmmaker about her work. This is time for a break. Do we have a new sponsor, Tom? I don't think we do. No new sponsor. So it is 8:31. So let us get you to news with our good friend David Jennings. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us this evening. As you've been listening, we have been talking about violence against women tonight and the many, many forms that it takes. We're joined now by Erica Valenciana. She is the director of a short documentary that is about sex trafficking, particularly in Ecuador. Erica, thanks for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you, Amy.
So tell us about the film.
Well, the film is called La Mitad del Mundo, which translates into the middle of the world, which is actually the name of the town that is at 0 degrees longitude and latitude. And the reason why it's named after that town is because that's where a safe house was located for the survivors of human trafficking in Ecuador. And the reason why I chose Ecuador and the middle of the world is because I felt it was representative of a problem that was happening everywhere, not just over there, which is how I feel most people view human trafficking. So I felt like it was important to show that this could just as easily happen anywhere in the United States, and does happen all the time in the United States.
Right. And I want to ask you more about that here in a second. But backing up a bit, what prompted you to take on this subject matter in the first place?
Well, I started this project a long time ago, and when I started, not as many people knew about it. And I think even though now a lot of people kind of have an awareness of it, I met a farmer who named his dog Liam after Liam Neeson because he exposes to human trafficking, in his films. But there's a lot of misconceptions about it still. So I feel like even though people have more of an awareness, we still need to keep being educated about it, because it's still shown as something that happens somewhere else. Even if it does happen to Americans, it's happening somewhere else. So we need to realize just how prevalent a problem it is in our country, in our backyard.
Yeah, well, so let's talk about those assumptions, because I think you're exactly right. I think that we have this idea that, human trafficking happens on the other side of the world, and maybe then the United States is a destination, but it's really, it's both directions, and it's happening all over the place. And so what are those other, you know, common misconceptions that people have about this topic?
Well, I think, you know, most people think it's only sex trafficking, but there's all kinds of human trafficking. You know, there's organ harvesting is a problem. There's a lot of issues with domestic servitude, where people will hire someone from another country and basically keep them prisoner in their home to clean and do all these things. There's a lot of people trafficked to work in factories, and they don't necessarily even always see it as exploitation themselves, because they're still getting paid more than they would for the same work in wherever they're from. So I've heard about like busts that the FBI has done, finding people in factories, you know, sleeping on like dirty mattresses and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of different kinds, and it's not only sex trafficking that happens. So we kind of have to be on the lookout, because it's very, it can be a very invisible thing. And I've, even when I've come across it and in my life, like it kind of, you don't recognize it immediately, you know, even if it's something that you kind of deal with a lot, which is what I'm doing with my film. So.
Yeah. I remember some of that in the book Fast Food Nation. I was thinking that as you were saying that, about, people that maybe didn't even realize how they were being exploited, that were brought to the United States to work in a, I think it was like a meat factory, meat processing plant or something, and kind of just dropped in these terrible conditions, but promised something better. So as you were, as you began the process of this film, how many times have you been to Ecuador?
Three times. So each time we went for a decent amount of time. So I've probably spent about 4 months total in Ecuador, combined with all the shoots. Yeah, and every single time I went, I get really bad altitude sickness, and it's like 30,000, you know, miles above sea level, and then the capital is. And then, so that was an issue, but then I would always get some kind of, like, unidentified intestinal bacteria and have to go, like, get an IV at the emergency room every single time, too.
Terrible.
It was like,
given the very sensitive nature of it, how are you finding sources, and how are you doing this work and approaching it and approaching the people involved in it?
Well, luckily I had a big support system. The people that I collaborated on the film with, a lot of them were psychologists and therapists who dealt with this. So as soon as I got there, like, they were just like, here's how we're going to help you. Here's how to interview the survivor correctly, and, like, this is the correct terminology that we're using, because a lot of people were still, and even now I'll still hear it every now and again. They say, like, white slavery, or, like, over there they call it, like, trata de blancas, like, so white woman trafficking or whatever. But, you know, so that's, like, a very outdated term, because that came from back when they were, like, kind of kidnapping white women and then sending them to the Middle East to be, like, the concubines for, like, royalty and stuff like that. But people still use that term, and also, you know, referring to the girls not as victims but as survivors.
Mm-hmm.
That was also, like, something I was taught as an important distinction. So, like, because they need to be empowered as much as possible, so you can't be referring to them as a victim but a survivor, because that's what they are.
Yeah. How old were the girls you were talking to?
Well, I started talking to them around the time they were like 13 or 14, because that is like the most kind of vulnerable age, like junior high kind of age. You know, and then I've known them now as they've like grown older, but yeah, most of the girls there were about that age range.
Wow.
I was lucky enough to have a friend kind of counsel me in the proper way to interview without re-traumatizing the survivor, you know, and kind of learning the specific terminology and then learning it in Spanish, because everything was in Spanish. So, yeah, you just had to be really kind of careful in the way you asked the questions, and but while still trying to get information that is going to help the audience later. And I mean, it's been a challenge, you know. I think part of the reason my project has taken so long is because it's such an emotionally tolling topic. And even, you know, now when I'm working with an editor, it's tough for her to watch the footage and hear all these horrible stories, you know. But I'm still in touch with a lot of the people that I worked with on the film and a lot of the survivors that I interviewed. And, you know, like we're all kind of in it together. There's a sense of community that, you know, we're all working towards the same goal, even if we have different roles.
What was surprising to you about the subject matter that you just didn't see coming when you first got into the project?
I think, I mean, there were like a lot of things that were surprising just hearing some of the stories that you thought, wow, I cannot believe this is real. But maybe hearing about people who were trafficked by their own families was pretty horrible. And I think, but like on a positive note, one of the reasons why I chose Ecuador as well is because they came so far in what they were doing to try to solve their problem. They recognized that they had a problem, and then they asked for help from the United States. And so they had a whole project that was organized by the American Bar Association there to fight against the trafficking. And so all these people came together. You know, they donated radio time. They donated their services and, you know, their personal time to train other people, train police officers and psychologists on how to identify survivors and how to help them, you know, because they had been criminalized up until that point. So to see such a small country take such strides in their problem, like really owning up to it, and then these incredible achievements. So that was surprising at how much this small place with not a lot of resources could do. So that makes me feel like, you know, than these bigger countries, like we should be able to achieve more then.
Right. Truly, truly. And so what emerged as a common theme as you were talking to survivors of trafficking?
Just the theme of exploitation, that people are going to try to take advantage in whichever way they can. And, you know, I think a lot of times people see, you know, specifically girls who have been sexually exploited as like, oh, well, you know, they're a certain type of girl, or they deserved it, or, you know, they were looking for it or whatever. But, you know, it's easy to manipulate a child, you know, because they're children. And so just because this has happened to them, it doesn't mean that they can't be rescued and go on to live a meaningful life after that. They're not throwaways. They just need some help, and once they get that help, they're able to fulfill, you know, go back to dreaming their dreams and living their lives.
Yeah, yeah. And so what is the timeline on your project at this point?
I would say we're at rough cut right now, and I think we'll be done within a couple months, like 2-3 months, something like that is what I anticipate. Right now I'm in the process of writing a lot of grants so I can pay all the people who are helping me make my film possible. So as much as I can pay them, you know, but there's still a lot of people who are, you know, I'll pay them some money and then they'll donate their time because they're so invested in the topic and they want to help, which is great, but everybody needs to buy food and pay their rent. So I want to be able to pay them as much as I can. And then there's other things that you just can't get for free either, you know, so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know. Indeed. Definitely. And so where can people go for more information about your film, but also, you know, maybe more information about some organizations that you worked with in this process?
Well, I'm in the process of applying for grants to develop a website so we can kind of link to the organizations that we're going to be working with. And I'm actually also in the process of kind of making, you know, building relationships with organizations. So that's still not out yet, but eventually we will have a website for specifically for the film that will have links. But I don't have a web address currently.
It happens. It happens. But we're going to just keep people in the loop about the film for sure. And we will definitely have you back on when it's out to talk about it again. All right. We have been talking with Erica Valenciana. She is the director of a short documentary film about sex trafficking. It is the translated name. I'm not going to butcher it in Spanish, but the translated name is The Middle of the World. And we will keep you up to date on that. And we will be sure and share those links with you once it comes out. We'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this has been the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick a big topic and we talk about it all night, and often we leave with more questions than answers. But it's important to have these conversations, because tonight's topic, we've been talking about the many different aspects of violence against women. And I know that seems like a big bummer of a topic, but in fact, we've been talking with people who are very, very hard at work in many of these areas, doing this work to try to combat the various ways that this manifests. And it's a problem. Not, as I said in the top of the show, it is not a women's problem. And I have to call out a couple of guys that have walked by the studio tonight on Michigan Avenue. A couple of times we came back from break and I announced the topic, and two guys in particular, like, their faces are burned into my head because they like flinched and ran away. Like they couldn't go there. And that's my problem. I'm sure they meant well. I'm sure that everybody means well. But at the end of the day, we got to help each other, because we got to fix all this. We've been talking about human trafficking, sex trafficking, labor trafficking. We've been talking about domestic violence and the many forms that it takes. It's not just bruises. It can be financial. It can be emotional. It can be a lot of things. And those are just two wings of this when we think about violence against women. We started the show talking a bit about rape culture and how perhaps we're holding our celebrities to different standards than we are holding the people in our lives, and how that needs to change, and how we have to combat all that by starting right away with the people in our lives and say, you know what, that joke is not funny. And hey, you know what, it's not okay to joke about that. Or hey, I'm concerned about what I think might be happening here. Or how does that make you feel? Or how is everything okay? And having these conversations. And I think the big takeaway for me from the show tonight, because I feel like I learn something every single show. But the big takeaway for me tonight on the show is that it's okay to have awkward conversations, and it's okay for them to be awkward. It's better to have them than to not have them. But again, it's not a women's issue, and it's not up to just women to deal with it and fix it. It's up to everybody, because for as long as there is any human being wielding power and abusing power over another person, that person needs help. And we need to be good allies and friends to those people. And change the culture, and that culture is around the world, as we've learned tonight. And yet, sometimes it's easier to think about it being on the other side of the world. We were talking with our filmmaker, Erica Valenciana, about the work she's doing on a documentary film around sex trafficking in Ecuador. And yet, we were also talking with our other guests who are doing Marie Anderson and Mary Munoz about their event coming up, because there's so much trafficking happening in Chicago, because it's a major hub. It's everywhere. It's everywhere, and we've got to fix that. And we have to talk about this issue much differently. And I know there's someone going, "Oh, politically correct nonsense." But you know what? If it changes culture, if someone could be helped by switching out one word, why would you not want to do that? And as I've often said, sometimes we can switch out the term politically correct for treating people with respect, and suddenly that'll shift the tone of the sentence quite a lot. So let's think about that. And if we suspect something's wrong, let's listen to our guts, and let's be willing to have awkward conversations to help people. And again, as I said at the very top of the show, while statistically speaking, domestic violence and human trafficking tends to happen to women more than men, nobody is exempt. it's happening around the world to lots and lots of people. So it's a conversation that we need to be having more often, and we need to remove victim blaming, and we need to remove any kind of sense of shame around it and have conversations and help one another out. Because there's a lot to it, and there's a lot here. And again, we will put all of the resources we have talked about tonight up on the website at WGNRadio.com with the podcast, and we'll be sure and share them on Facebook if you're connected to me. If you find me on Facebook, I'm at Amy G-U-T-H everywhere on every social platform, and I'll be sure and tweet this out and share it on Facebook and all that. And I will include links to all of the resources that we mentioned. And I hope they're helpful to you, and I hope that someone who needs those resources has found some bit of useful information tonight. So let us all help each other, and let us all be safe and do all those things. All right. We will see you next time here on the Saturday Night Special.